Jewish Background to the New Testament by Robert C. Newman. Abstract: a survey of the history of the intertestament period as it bears on our understanding of the New Testament. The period is subdivided on the basis of who is ruling the land of Israel: Persia, Greece, the Hasmoneans, or Rome. Several cultural matters are also discussed. Regarding the intertestament period, period between the end of the Old Testament, beginning of the New Testament, it's valuable to know something of this period due to big changes that have taken place between the Old Testament and New Testament periods. The Old Testament ends around 400 B.C. The New Testament begins around 4 B.C., almost 4 centuries gap. The government at the end of the Old Testament is Persia, in control of Palestine and Israel, and Rome at the beginning of the New Testament. The languages in the Old Testament period that we hear about, that we see in the text, actually, of the Old Testament, are Hebrew and Aramaic. In the New Testament period, these languages are still around, and we have some indications of them here there in the text. But the New Testament period adds Greek, in which the New Testament is written, and also Latin as well. The Old Testament culture that we're in contact with in the Old Testament is Semitic, and the New Testament culture is what we call Hellenistic. The geographic center of the Old Testament is what we call the Fertile Crescent, and of the New Testament, the geographic center is the Mediterranean. Here's a picture of the Fertile Crescent shown on the map. This is a relatively well-watered area lying between the Mediterranean Sea on the west and the Persian Gulf on the east, and it's called a crescent because it runs northward from the Persian Gulf up the Tigris and Euphrates valleys and then turns and runs downward to the Mediterranean coast near the Old Testament period city of Ugarit, and then down along the Syrian, Phoenician, Palestinian coast. And we can see it there on the map. We have a number of sources of information on the intertestament period. One of these is the Bible itself. As far as we know, none of the Bible is written strictly during the intertestament period, that is from after 400 to before 4 BC. But there's Old Testament prediction regarding events of the intertestament period, especially in the book of Daniel. Besides the Old Testament, we have works that we classify in the Old Testament Apocrypha and the Old Testament Pseudepigrapha, which give us information about this period as well. First, Second Maccabees, particularly the more novelistic works of Judith and Tobit, would fall into this particular category. Some additions to Daniel, Bell and the Dragon, and such. The author Philo of Alexandria, who was born perhaps around 20 B.C. and lived sometime after AD 40, is a significant source of information for this period, particularly in regard to the Hellenistic interactions of the Jews, some of the anti-Semitism that was going on at his time, and regarding interactions of Jews with Greek philosophy and Greek culture. From around the same time, a little bit later, is Josephus, known perhaps better as Flavius Josephus. He's a Jerusalem Jew, and born, as you can see, shortly after Jesus' ministry, AD 37, and lived till shortly after 100 AD. And he's pretty significant. He belongs to a well-to-do priestly family. He identifies himself with the Pharisees. He's involved in both sides of the Jewish revolt against Rome, 66 to 73, and is a very important source of information regarding the history of Israel and Palestine from the period, the end of the Intertestament period, down to down to about 80 A.D. In addition to these sources, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, one, give us some of the earliest copies we have of Old Testament writings, but on top of that as well, give us some particular writings by the group. We think the group that settled at Qumran, and we believe these are a group that we call the Essenes, or that were called the Essenes through much of history. It wasn't apparently their own name. some of the diversity within Judaism in the late Intertestament period. And then finally, we have what we call the rabbinic literature, the literature that comes down to us from the descendants of the Pharisees, the successors to the Pharisees. And this material, probably the earliest written material we have, would be out near 200 A.D., but it involves writing down material that was being circulated orally for perhaps a couple centuries or more before that time. We have a good deal of reference to two rabbis who would be older contemporaries of Jesus' earthly ministry, Hillel and Shammai, whose dates are perhaps a little bit earlier than Philo's would be, but they're living in Palestine and they're very Jewish, not so Hellenistic as Philo is. Well, that's at least a tour of the major sources we have on the Intertestament period. I mentioned that the prophetic material in Daniel gives us some insight into the Intertestament period, and one of these would be what we might call Daniel's overview of the Intertestament period. This shows up in two passages in Daniel chapter 2, the vision of Nebuchadnezzar's image. There we see in Daniel 2 the image described, and this picture on the right gives you a little idea of it, a human formed statue, or a statue that looks human, that has a golden head and a silver upper body and a bronze lower body and iron legs and iron and clay feet. And basically the gold head, the silver chest, the bronze thighs, the iron legs, and the iron and clay feet are what's described in the vision of Daniel 2. And then we have some action in the vision. The image is destroyed by a stone, which then grows to be a mountain and then fills the whole earth after the fragments of the image have blown away. We also have another picture, Daniel's four wild animals, found in Daniel chapter 7. Where Daniel has a vision, the other was Nebuchadnezzar's vision, that successive animals come out of the sea. Here's an artist's conception of what they look like. There's a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a terrible beast, which here this author has represented of a dinosaurish look, which was also my choice when I invented a picture of them as well. A lion is somewhat unusual in that it is reared up on its rear feet and has a human heart given to it. The leopard is tilted over on one side. The bear is tilted over on one side and gnawing on bones. The leopard has four heads, and the terrible beast has 10 horns initially, but then in the vision we see an eleventh horn come up from the this fourth animal, and this horn tears up three other horns, etc. Then in the vision, thrones are set up, and the Ancient of Days takes his seat, and the wild animals are judged, but the lifetime of the of three of the animals, the first, second, and third, is preserved for a while, but they do not have their power. And then one, like a son of man, receives an eternal universal kingdom. That's Daniel's picture of the four wild animals. If we make a little chart, we can see that these, from the interpretations given and such, we can see that these kingdoms correspond to certain features of the vision and certain features of the animals. The Neo-Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar and his followers corresponds to the gold head on the image and the lion with wings in the animal. The Medo-Persian or Persian Empire corresponds to the silver chest of the image and the bear tilted up on one side and eating. The Kingdom of Greece corresponds to the bronze thighs of the image and the four-headed leopard. The Kingdom of Rome corresponds to the iron legs and of the image and the terrible ten-horned beast among the animals. Well, we're going to use a scheme to structure our survey. More could be said about it, but we're going to do that. And so the structure of our survey will be this way. We're going to look, first of all, at Palestine and the Persians. The Babylonians are come and gone before the Old Testament ends, so we're going to look at Palestine and the Persians, which runs from about 539 B.C. to about 331 B.C. Then Palestine under the Greeks, and that runs from about 331 BC to about 160 BC. And then independence under the Hasmoneans, and that runs from about 160 BC down over a century to 63 BC. And then Palestine under the Romans, and that runs from 63 BC to AD 135, which is where we'll stop, and then actually runs on beyond for several more centuries until the followers of Muhammad come into the area in the 600s. Well, let's have a look then. So we'll call our first section Palestine under Persia, 539 to 331 BC. We can sketch the Palestine under Persia under these big headings. The rise of Cyrus, the return of the Jews, the rebuilding of the temple, the revival in Judah and rebuilding the walls, the Aramaic language, the rise of the synagogue, and the intertestament temples. Let's have a look at those. In 559 BC, while Babylon is still ruling in Palestine, a fellow named Cyrus inherits the small kingdom of Anshan, which later comes to be called Persia. He is under the control of the Medes at that time, kind of a subject king to the Medes. But by 550, Cyrus has succeeded in defeating the Medes. He'd actually been getting some financial support from the Babylonians with the idea that if they encouraged rebellion among the subject kingdoms under the Medes, that would keep the Medes weak, and it kind of backfires here because Cyrus defeats the Medes, and so the Babylonian king at this point, Nabonidus, cancels his support. By 546, Cyrus has taken all of Asia Minor, what is modern Turkey today. So he, instead of immediately trying to attack the Babylonians, he rather goes off in another direction and conquers Asia Minor as well. So he now has the Median Kingdom Empire and the area of Asia Minor in his own territory. Cyrus uses a strategy of trying to get the people he's defeated on his side rather than thoroughly antagonizing them. And so becomes king of the Medes rather than just destroying the Median kingdom, if you like. Finally, in 539, Cyrus takes Babylon, and at this point then he has come to control not only all the territory that the Babylonian Empire had, but actually a bigger empire as well. After Cyrus comes to control his empire, we see an event that is quite important in Jewish history, and that's the return of the Jews from the Babylonian captivity. This takes place, at least initially, in the period 539 to 530 BC. Cyrus is concerned to stabilize his empire and was aware of problems that he might have, and one of them would be the problem of disgruntled conquered people. And so Cyrus cancels the policy which the previous empires had, and that was deporting people from their homeland and moving them to other locations. Both the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire had tended to be triumphalist and try to grind their enemies in the dust, if you like, and Cyrus is concerned not to do something of the sort. So Cyrus tries to be considerate, and one of the things he does then is he cancels the Assyrian and Babylonian deportation policy, and he allows the Jews and other deported people to return home if they like. So Cyrus comes across religiously as very considerate, which the Assyrians and Babylonians were not, and he allows the deported people to return home, and the upshot of that is the Jews are allowed to return home, God working through this ruler in having this happen. Well, when the Jews return to their own homeland, one of their immediate projects is to rebuild the temple. We call this the second temple when it finally gets built, the first temple being Solomon's temple. Cyrus allowed the rebuilding of the temple to start, but stopped it when the various neighboring nations right around Israel opposed. We see this in Ezra chapters 4 and 6. Cyrus then dies, and his son rules briefly, and then when he dies, there's no heir to the throne, and one of the relatives, Darius, eventually is able to get control of the Persian Empire. And when Darius comes to the throne, the Jews had been loyal to him and not rebelling during all of this thing, and so Jewish loyalty was rewarded by allowing them to rebuild the Second Temple. This temple then is completed in 515 B.C., at the instigation of two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, two of the last prophets in the Old Testament, and by the Jewish governor Zerubbabel, a descendant of David, and by the high priest Jeshua or Joshua. These four figures figure rather importantly in the rebuilding of the temple. This temple, called by the Jews the Second Temple, lasts from 515 B.C. until it's destroyed by the Romans in A.D. 70. And so the upshot is that the Jews call this period the Second Temple period rather than the Intertestament period, since they do not recognize New Testament as part of the Bible, and they do not call the Old Testament the Old Testament, but they call it the Bible or the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh, the Torah, Navi'im, Ketuvim, the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. Well, under the Persians, we have some revival and rebuilding. Things apparently aren't going too well after the temple has been rebuilt, and people are settling down and concerned about themselves and not too concerned about the worship of God. But under the Persian king Artaxerxes I, who reigns in 465 to 423, so some 50 years after Darius rules, we begin to get some of this revival. In 458 B.C., Artaxerxes allows the priest Ezra to return from Babylon with a commission to restore people to observing the law. Ezra is pictured not only as a priest, but also as a scribe, as one who is a specialist in the Old Testament scriptures. And then in 445, Nehemiah, the cupbearer of Artaxerxes, Jewish fellow also, is sent by Artaxerxes as governor to rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem. The rebuilding city walls are quite important. In modern times, we distinguish a city from a town or a village or something of that sort just by its size. But in antiquity, the important thing about a city was not so much its size, though that was important, but was its fortification. If a settlement had a good wall around it that could resist a siege and that sort of thing, then it was considered a city. But if it didn't, then it was considered a village, even though it was quite large, with a few exceptions in antiquity. So Nehemiah rebuilding the city walls of Jerusalem makes Jerusalem a city again, and one that can now stand better against opponents, as the even in the Persian Empire, the Jews had a good deal of opposition from neighboring groups around them. We see that in the book of Nehemiah, in fact. With fortifications in place, Jerusalem is now a city again. This is probably the place to say a little bit about the Aramaic language. The Aramaic language is the ancient language of Syria, our typical modern term, or as it's called in biblical studies, Aram. So the land of Aram and the language Aramaic, the territory in the upper Euphrates Valley. The Aramaic language, in the course of several centuries, had become the diplomatic and trade language of the ancient Near East, so that the Assyrians and the Babylonians used it in administering the western part, at least, of their empires. When the Jews were carried off into captivity for the 70 years for the southern Jews, and a longer period of time than that for the northern Jews, then as they settled in various places, it was necessary for them for getting along with their neighbors and trade and all that sort of thing to adopt some common language, and this was the language which the Jews generally adopted. So you got a situation probably during the Babylonian exile, perhaps around 550 B.C. or so, as a generation or so into the exile, that the Jews growing up now in those areas were speaking Aramaic and did not even know Hebrew very well. Rather similar sort of situation you would see with people from overseas who settled in the United States and whose initial language is not English. Think of the Chinese or the Koreans or the Germans or things of that sort. Then they continued to use their language some for a century or so, but but they need to learn the local language, and they do so, etc. And we see that very strongly in, say, Korean immigrants today who, in a generation or two in, know English better than they know Korean, etc. So it was adopted by the Jews. The upshot was that in Jewish worship, you eventually got a number of Jewish people who did not really know Hebrew well, and so it was necessary for their edification in the worship services to provide a translation when the Bible was read. And so we begin to get oral translations of the Old Testament into Aramaic that are made probably initially just on the spot by a translator in the service, and then it became more traditional, and people were concerned about the quality of the translation and such. And so you got, after a while, we think people who had memorized a translation and some conditions on how literal it needed to be and things of that sort. Well, that's what we get. They're called the Targums, and these oral translations into Aramaic are still in use at the time of Jesus, and then sometimes after that, these oral translations begin to be written down, and we do have some of these surviving translations even today. Since Aramaic had become kind of the dominant language of the Jews in this period of time, Aramaic is used in rabbinic literature, even after Hebrew ceases to be used. Hebrew is being used as late as 200 A.D. or so, but after that you begin to see Aramaic language being used, and that continues on up to 550 or so, and then it begins to be replaced by other languages. About the same general time, we have the rise of the synagogue. The synagogue is a place of worship for Jews who are unable to attend the temple. The form of worship in the synagogue is that there was prayer, there was Bible study, probably singing, things of that sort, but there was no sacrifice, and it may be that they used no musical instruments as well in their singing. We don't know for sure how that stood early on. The origin of the synagogue is obscure, but commonest suggestion is that it occurred sometime during the period of the Babylonian exile, but in fact there is some evidence in the Old Testament that there were places of worship besides the temple in Old Testament times. There, of course, were the high places, but there's some remarks that may suggest that there were something like synagogues that were being used in villages where you were far from Jerusalem, and you couldn't expect to get down to Jerusalem except during the pilgrim festivals three times a year. Whatever in that direction, the synagogue continued to exist after the Second Temple was rebuilt, and in fact, we find that by New Testament times, there are quite a few synagogues even in Jerusalem itself, so they began to pick up other purposes. They became social centers. They became places where people of the same linguistic background, perhaps returned slaves that spoke Latin or Greek or something of that sort, freedmen of various sorts, could worship with one another. When the temple was destroyed after 70 A.D., the synagogue became the only place of Jewish worship, and then continued that way until the present day. So this period of the Persian control of Palestine, we think, sees the rise of the synagogue as well. We should say something about the temples during the Intertestament period, and this will carry us a little outside our period of the Persian domination of Palestine. But the Second Temple, what we might call the Second Jerusalem Temple, was built during the Persian period, 515, continued on to 70 AD, as we mentioned. It was basically Orthodox and was on the site of Solomon's Temple. And the little picture in the upper right-hand corner here shows you the Jerusalem Temple model at the Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem. There was a Samaritan temple there in the same time period as well. We're not quite sure when it was built, and the suggestions range from 450 B.C. to 330 B.C., but we do know when it was destroyed. It was destroyed during the Maccabean or Hasmonean period at about 128 B.C. This was Samaritan temple, okay, so it represented the Samaritan outlook, which differed from the Orthodox Jerusalem Jewish outlook in certain ways. We know, for instance, that they had a smaller Old Testament canon, that they accepted the five books of Moses and a version of Joshua. It was located on Mount Gerizim near Shechem, presumably in John 4, where the Samaritan woman says to Jesus, "Our fathers worship on this mountain," that she's probably gesturing over to Mount Gerizim, which would have been right nearby there as she's speaking to him. It was destroyed by the Maccabees, as I said, in 128 B.C., and was one of several reasons why the Jews and the Samaritans did not get along well at all. It's still a holy site at New Testament times, as we suggested from the incident with Samaritan woman in John 4, and in fact, it's still a holy site today, and the Samaritans still hold annual Passover observances up there. And there are only a few hundred Samaritans at this point, but they do still exist. There was the third temple, that we call it the Elephantine Temple. It didn't have anything directly to do with elephants, but it was located on an island called Elephantine in the Nile, a good ways up the Nile River, that is south on the Nile River, down on a map to us, but upstream. That was built, we think, around 525 B.C., during the time which the Jews who had not been carried off to Babylon, many of them were down in Egypt. And it continued to about 390 B.C., with a Jewish community continuing after that as well. We know about this really only through some surviving papyri that come from this particular settlement down there, a group of Jews who were hired, apparently, by the Persians to, to function as mercenary soldiers and to protect the southern border of their empire. Later on, during problems connected with the events surrounding the Maccabean Revolt, a group of Jews founded a temple much further north in Egypt at Leontopolis, which was built about 160 B.C. and survived actually past the Jerusalem Temple to about 72 A.D. Well, that's a quick tour of Palestine under the Persians. We move along to talk about Palestine under the Greeks, and we run this as from 331 B.C. to around 160 B.C. We'll see why I give that around 160 B.C. That's because of the kind of fuzzy nature of the success of the Maccabean Revolt at that time. The kind of topics we're going to look at under Palestine under the Greeks. First of all, Alexander the Great. That's how Palestine came under the Greeks. His career, if you like, spanned 336 to 323 B.C. The struggle for succession after the untimely death of Alexander ran on from 323 to 301 B.C. And then the Ptolemaic dynasty came to control parts of the Middle East and Palestine for a while, and that continued down to 30 B.C. with the suicide of Cleopatra. And they controlled Palestine from 301 to 198 B.C. We also have the Seleucid dynasty. These two are actually descendants of the successors to Alexander the Great, or people who succeeded in getting a piece of his empire. The Seleucid dynasty continues till only 63 B.C. when the Romans succeeded in grabbing control a good deal of the Middle East. And they controlled Palestine from 198 to about 160 B.C. when they were ousted by the Maccabean Revolt. And we'll talk a little bit about Hellenism under this as well, and about the translation of the Bible, the Old Testament, into Greek, which we call the Septuagint. Well, let's look at those. Alexander was the son of Philip II, I believe he is called, who was the ruler of Macedon, a significant territory north of Greece, and differed from Greece in that although many of them spoke Greek up there, Philip controlled a rather large territory where the Greeks were basically little city-states that controlled varying amounts of territory. Alexander's father, Philip, was assassinated in 336, and Alexander was quite young then, but with already substantial military experience, he'd already functioned as a general under his father, and so he succeeded his father at age 20, and it took him a couple of years to restabilize the territory that his father had controlled and get solid control of it himself. He set as a project for his reign the revenge against the Persians who had invaded Greece in the previous century or so, and so he, with a rather small army, invaded Asia Minor in 334 B.C. In a series of rather striking victories in the following years. In 334 at the Granicus River, he destroyed the Persian army that protected the western end of Asia Minor, and that opened all of Asia Minor to him. Spent the next year establishing control of that and building up his army and such, And then when the Persians came back with another army brought in from Persia, they fought at Issus, 333, and again, Alexander, with a smaller army, succeeded in destroying a bigger army, and at this point opening up Syria and Palestine and Egypt to his invasion. Finally, after establishing control in that area, the Persians brought up one last army against him at Gaugamela, and that was destroyed, and within a few months, the last Persian king was captured, actually was killed by some of his followers as they were near being captured, and Alexander then became controller of the whole Persian Empire. Alexander then, in the following year, continues on to India, and finally his troops are ready to rebel. They've had enough fighting and want to go back and enjoy the spoils, and Alexander reluctantly then gives in and goes back. And Alexander dies in Babylon in the year 323 at age 33, after having conquered probably as big an empire as anyone had ever controlled in the world up to that time. Here's a little map of Alexander's empire shown in kind of a dingy green here, a green-gray, and we can see it ranges in the northwest from Macedonia and Thrace down around the through Asia Minor and around the Levantine or East Mediterranean coast down into Egypt, and then runs down the Tigris-Euphrates valleys to the Persian Gulf, and then runs across the areas we think of as Afghanistan and Iran and such, and runs on over off this picture, but all the way over to the Indus River edge of west edge of India. That's Alexander's empire. The three major battles we mentioned, the Battle of the Granicus River took place up here where that oval is seen, the Battle of Issus down where that middle oval is seen, and then the Battle of Gaugamela, where this most easternmost oval is seen. Well, when Alexander died in 323, did not have an heir. His son was a baby, and I think perhaps even not born right when when Alexander died, but born soon thereafter. And the baby then dies young. Do not know whether any foul play was involved or not. Alexander did have a brother, but the brother was mentally incompetent. And so when it became clear that the baby was dead, the generals fell to fighting. And the empire then divided, and the various pieces and their sizes and such changed shape for a while. But eventually, as things settled down, Thrace in the far northwest came to be ruled by one of Alexander's generals, Lysimachus. Macedonia nearby came to be ruled by another general, Cassander. And then Asia Minor and Mesopotamia, and nearly over to India, the biggest piece, came to be ruled by Seleucus, and Egypt and Syria by Ptolemy. And our concern will be with these last two, who their descendants come to rule over Palestine for periods of time during the Intertestament period. Basically, Lysimachus got Thrace, Cassander got Macedon below him, Seleucus gets this whole big middle section, and Ptolemy gets this lower southwest section. A little about the Ptolemaic dynasty. It lasts till 30 BC, as I said, until the suicide of Cleopatra, who was a descendant of the Ptolemies. They controlled Palestine for just over a century, 301 BC to 198 BC. Ptolemy managed to grab off Palestine while the other generals were fighting a general we haven't mentioned yet, Antigonus, who looked like he was going to get the big share in the middle until the other general ganged up on him. If you've ever played the war game of Risk, you know how that works sometimes, that when it looks like somebody is getting ready to dominate things, it may be the other players will gang up against him. Ptolemy's successors, almost all of whom were named Ptolemy, the men were, several of the women were named Cleopatra, actually treat the Jews fairly well, ups and downs, but fairly well. And the upshot was that many Jews settled in Alexandria, which became the capital of the Ptolemaic dynasty, a city named, I think, by Alexander, for Alexander, but then comes to be the kind of the Greek city in Egypt and the capital of the Ptolemaic dynasty. Seleucid dynasty lasts till 63 BC, and it controls Palestine for a couple of generations, 198 to 160 BC, that is, that's just a generation. It gets Palestine. The Seleucid dynasty does after a long series of wars with the Ptolemies. The Seleucid rulers tend to be named Seleucus and Antiochus, with a few other names thrown in here and there. And Antiochus IV comes to rule for a while and favors the Hellenized Jews and allows them to reestablish Jerusalem as a Hellenistic city. I'll say more about that under Hellenism. Antiochus later attempts to abolish Judaism in 168 BC, and this leads to the Maccabean Revolt in 167. So what about this term, Hellenism? Hellenism comes from the Greek word for Greece, Hellas. The word Greece is borrowed from the Latins. That was the name that they gave to the Greeks. Hellenism is the name for Greek culture as it developed in the East after Alexander. That is, Greek culture exported to many people who were not Greeks, but who were influenced by the Greek city-states that Alexander founded throughout his territory, and who had come to speak Greek and adopt Greek culture and such. So we hear now and then in the New Testament about Hellenists who are typically Greek-speaking Jews. Perhaps one passage in the New Testament in Acts refers to Hellenists as just Greek speakers who aren't Greeks, that is, Syrians or something of the sort. But in any case, that's a name for Greek culture as it developed in the East after Alexander. Hellenism had a substantial influence on Judaism and was probably somewhat influenced by it as well, that a number of people who had a Greek culture were interested in the religion of the Jews, and particularly when the Bible came to be translated into Greek. Hellenism typically included religious mixing of one sort or another. The Greeks themselves worshipped a pantheon of gods, male and female, of whom the chief god was Zeus, and you've heard perhaps of Hera, and certainly you've heard of Athena, and Ares, the god of war, and that sort of thing. When the Greek and the Roman culture came together, a lot of these Greek gods were given by the Romans their Roman names, Jupiter and Juno and such. But the same thing happened in the East as well. When the Greek culture came into Syria, the Baals and their various other gods and goddesses were renamed with Greek names as well. So we get religious mixing called syncretism. Part of the trouble arises then when people attempt to do some syncretism with the religion of the Old Testament as well. Hellenism also involved various Greek philosophies and their attempts to try and visualize the whole universe by various particular means and trying to understand what all reality was about. Hellenism also involved politics and economics. It was obviously beneficial to live in one of the Greek city-states, one of these transplanted types of Greek city-states in the East, Antioch and Ptolemais and Alexandria and such, and even better to actually be a citizen of one of those city-states. Citizenship wasn't automatic with being born in the city, but you had to be born to a citizen, and the original citizens were assigned there by political authority of some sort of king or something, and then later kings could give citizenship to people. So substantial benefits in regard to political power and economics for being a citizen. I want to say a word or two about the Septuagint, often abbreviated by the Latin term for 70, LXX. This was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, the earliest one that we know about, we do know something about its origin in a work called the Letter of Aristeus. We're not real sure how much of the information Aristeus gives is authentic, but he basically tells us that the second ruler of the Ptolemies in Egypt, Ptolemy II, is building a big library in Alexandria, and someone recommends to him that he should have the law of the Jews. And so according to the story, Ptolemy II has a group of Jewish elders, 72 of them, I believe, brought down from Jerusalem to come down to Alexandria and translate this Jewish law for his library, translate the Greek. The story gets a little more elaborated as we move away from the letter of Aristeus implies that there were 72 of these people, and they did it in 72 days. Later additions to the story have the translators divided up into 36 groups of two, and each group of two does the whole Old Testament, and they turn out to all have identical Old Testaments. A miracle to assure you that the translation is really a great translation. Other things of that sort are added to the story, but the initial idea was, appears anyway, that the it's a translation of the law, that is the five books of Moses, but the later editions of the story make it the whole Old Testament. It's certainly fair to say that eventually the whole Old Testament is translated into Greek, but it doesn't look like it was all done by one group, and we don't think it was all done at one time. General opinion of the story today is that the letter of Aristeus contains elements that are accurate and contains stuff that surely is not, but telling the exact boundary between which and which is not always easy to say. Now, we don't have time machines, after all. Importance of this translation of the Old Testament to Greek. It's the longest translation of any writing from antiquity. It gives the Old Testament text a century before the oldest surviving Hebrew manuscripts. So we actually have the text of the Greek Old Testament from before the time we have the text of the oldest Hebrew manuscripts. That doesn't mean that the Hebrew manuscripts may not preserve an older text. In fact, we think they do in general. But important early witness to the text of the Old Testament. The Septuagint as a long material in Greek from God, from the Old Testament, sets the pattern for Greek theological terms in the New Testament. And so many of the theological terms used in the New Testament, you can see, already have a history in terms that were used by the translators to translate various Hebrew words. It put the Old Testament in the universal language of the Mediterranean world from 300 B.C. when Alexander conquers the area to about 600 A.D., so for nearly a millennium, that was the universal language of at least the Eastern Mediterranean. And the Septuagint became the Old Testament for the early church. We move on to independence under the Hasmoneans, 160 B.C. to 63 B.C. The topics we're going to discuss under this heading are Antiochus IV and the Abomination Desolation, the Maccabean Revolt, 167 to 134, the Hasmonean Dynasty, 164 to 63, the Jewish sects of the period, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Well, let's have a look. Antiochus Epiphanes is an important early actor in this whole thing. He's the reason that there is a desire among the Jews to revolt. Antiochus Epiphanes is one of the descendants of the Seleucid dynasty. Descendants of Seleucus, one of Alexander's generals, and Antiochus was regent holding the throne for his nephew when his brother passed away, and in 175 B.C. Antiochus usurps the throne from his nephew and begins to rule on his own. Antiochus tries to unify his empire by means of Hellenism. The Seleucids faced a difficult problem with their empire, which was very ethnically diverse, on how to unify it. The Ptolemies had an empire that was largely Egyptian, with a veneer of Greeks on top of it, but the Seleucids did not, quite diverse, and so he tried to unify his empire by Hellenism, that is to get all of these people to adopt a Greek culture. So, in Jerusalem, he favors the Hellenistic Jews, and some of these Hellenistic Jews ask him if he will not refound Jerusalem as Antiochia and make them the citizens, make them the rulers of the place, and he does. The result is he eventually deposes the high priest who was of a more Hebraistic sort in favor of that high priest's brother who was more Hellenistic, and then a couple of years later deposes that high priest in favor of another Hellenistic high priest who offers him more money. So Onias III is deposed in favor of his brother Jason, and Jason deposed in favor of a Menelaus, who is a Jewish priest, but did not even belong to the high priestly family. In 168 B.C., in the course of Antiochus attempting to add Egypt to his empire, he is defeated by the Romans, who have begun to take an interest in the Middle East. And Antiochus is very upset about this, and as he returns back from being defeated by the Romans, he tries to destroy Judaism There had been a revolt by the followers of Jason against the followers of Menelaus, and Antiochus decides that he's going to get rid of all this problem by wiping out the Jewish religion and making all the Jews convert over to a Hellenistic religion. Actually, Antiochus is called Antiochus Epiphanes because he imagined himself to be the manifestation, the epiphany, of Zeus, the chief god of the Roman pantheism. So he tries to destroy Judaism, rededicates the temple to Zeus. This leads to the what we call the Maccabean Revolt. Its origin starts with an old priest named Mattathias, who lived when he was off duty in the town of Modin to the northwest of Jerusalem, and had a number of grown sons. When the various officers of Antiochus were sent out into the countryside around Jerusalem to enforce the new laws that forbid circumcision and that sought to destroy copies of the scripture and require Jews to eat pork and sacrifice to Zeus and things of that sort, the aged priest Mattathias resisted, and then in the middle of this resistance they killed a Jew who had agreed to sacrifice, and then killed the little detachment of soldiers that had come to try and enforce this, and as a result he and his sons had to flee to the wilderness for fear of the retaliation that would come as soon as this word got back to headquarters in Jerusalem what was going on. Well, Mattathias dies fairly quickly and is succeeded by one of his sons, not the oldest son, but the one who had shown the most military abilities, who we call Judah the Maccabee, who is lives till 160 when he is killed in battle, but who kind of runs the revolt from 166 to 160. The term the Maccabee is kind of a battle epithet, rather like Stonewall and Stonewall Jackson, or Light Horse Harry and Light Horse Harry Lee, one of the heroes of the Revolution, etc., U.S. Revolution. Judah succeeds his father then, and his nickname, the Maccabee, actually means the hammer, Judah the Hammer. He leads the Jews in a successful series of battles in which they're able to win against against larger armies by ambush and things of that sort, and each time they win, they get more followers come over to their side, and the Seleucids don't take the revolt seriously enough initially, so they don't scale up their forces sent into Israel fast enough, and the result is that Judah manages to drive them out. He's killed in battle in 160 and succeeded by his brother Jonathan to 142, and then succeeded by his last brother Simon to 134. During this period, Jonathan and Simon, the Seleucids, are weak, and the Maccabeans are able to grow in power by diplomacy. But both Jonathan and Simon are murdered in all of this, but Simon finally manages to start a dynasty that he is an adult son who is able to take over from him. That brings us to the Hasmonean dynasty. The rulers descended from Simon of the family of the Maccabees, and the first ruler here is John Hyrcanus, rules from 134 to 104. He's able to greatly expand Judean territory. It's during his reign that we first hear in Josephus about the rise of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and so they apparently come around sometime in this period. May well have started earlier than that. We often don't hear about a movement until it gets big enough to attract attention. John Hyrcanus dies in 104. His son Aristobulus takes over in 103, kills off most of his brothers, and takes the title king. He's the first one of these Hasmoneans to take the title king. Before this, they had been high priest and ruler. Aristobulus dies rather quickly from his own fears, rather paranoid, although killing off a bunch of his brothers obviously made a lot of enemies, drinking too much, and has some trouble with disease as well. He does have a surviving brother, however, Alexander Janaeus, who rules for, as we can see here, 26 years. Alexander marries the widow of Aristobulus and continues expanding the territory under Jewish control until we get a territory that's up towards the size of Solomon's empire. Alexander gets in trouble with the Pharisees, and that's a long story which we'll not develop here with the time we've got available. But from there on, the Sadducees are kind of on the outs with the Hasmoneans, and the Pharisees are kind of on the outs with the Hasmoneans, and the Sadducees are kind of on the ins with the Hasmoneans.
Mm-hmm.
In 76, with the death of Alexander Janaeus, we have the widow, who had been the wife of both of the brothers, succeeds, and she rules for a little under 10 years as Salome Alexandra. She succeeds at Alexander's death and has two sons. And Hyrcanus II is made high priest. Salome can't be the high priest. And Aristobulus II, who is more able of the two, I think, at least organizationally, is given military command. The trouble is that this arrangement, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, is going to lead to serious troubles with Salome's death. Salome dies, and she's succeeded by Hyrcanus II, who is high priest, but Hyrcanus is not really a powerful, forceful ruler, and his younger brother, Aristobulus, is very ambitious. The upshot is Aristobulus snatches the throne, Hyrcanus flees, opens a war against Aristobulus and calls on Rome for help. We'll come back and deal with that when we come to deal with Palestine under the Romans. During this period, we begin to see evidence of the what come to be the three main groups of Jews during New Testament times. We hear about these in some detail in Josephus and some less detail in Philo. These three groups are the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. A word about their theology. The Pharisees are what we might call somewhat Calvinistic, and the Sadducees are somewhat Arminian, and the Essenes maybe even a little on the hyper-Calvinistic side, using all later Christian terminology. The Pharisees are willing to remain in society, though they do consider themselves separatists to a certain extent. They have considerable support from the people as a whole, which the Sadducees and the Essenes do not have anything like that. They are kind of a lay operation, if you like. That is, there are certainly Pharisees who are priests, but the Pharisees, by and large, are laity, concerned to repent and bring God's favor back to Israel by seeking to be very pure. The Sadducees are somewhat more in the compromising direction. They're influenced by Hellenism for much of their history, perhaps because they're in upper ruling echelons. They tend to be upper class people. They tend to deny certain doctrines that had become widely accepted at this point, the doctrine of the existence or activity of angels, of the resurrection, that sort of thing. And so they look a little bit more like modern liberals in certain ways, perhaps. The Essenes are even super Pharisees to a certain extent. They refuse to take part in the temple activities, apparently feeling it's polluted. Many of them live off by themselves. Many of them do not marry. They have a great interest in angels and have secret books of their own, whereas the Pharisees appear to operate with what we would think of as our Old Testament canon. Sadducees, there's been some argument about, but the evidence I think we have is that they accepted the Old Testament canon, but perhaps favored the law very much over the prophets and the writings. Well, we've said a bit about their theology already then in describing these three main groups. Their influence, the Pharisees had the widest support of the average Jews. By the way, the Jews weren't divided up into these three groups. None of these groups were really big compared to the size of the whole Jewish population. But the Pharisees were the most influential. The Sadducees had the most government authority. They shared it with the Pharisees, but Sadducees dominated that. And the Essenes were off by themselves. Survival, the Sadducees kind of destruct with the revolt and the temple destruction in 70 AD. The Essenes, probably some of that as well, except that some of their writings that were stashed away survived to become the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Pharisees survived to become the rabbis and lead to the Orthodox Judaism of the medieval period, if you like, from them. So a quick tour on their influence and survival. We need to rush on here. Palestine under the Romans, 63 BC to about 135 AD. We'll sketch here the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, 63, the Pax Romana, Pax Romana, Roman peace, 30 BC to 170 AD, the Herod family, and messianic expectation, and the end of the Jewish state. When the when Aristobulus took over control of Palestine, of Israel, from Hyrcanus, Hyrcanus fled his brother Aristobulus. He got the Romans to intervene in the dispute, and the Romans win. And they depose Aristobulus. They put Hyrcanus back in, not as king, but as a ethnarch, and Judea loses most of its conquered territories. Hyrcanus, as I say, was made ethnarch of Judea instead of king, and the Romans now rule Palestine as what we call a client state. That would be a state in which there's a native governor, a native ruler, king or something, but the Romans are over them, if you like, or a province, a territory in which the Romans actually send their own governor in instead of a native ruler. And one or the other of those from 63 BC all the way out to AD 639. We call the period from 30 BC to 170 AD Roman peace. 2 centuries of peace over the Roman Empire, beginning with Augustus. It's not true that there was no warfare anywhere in the empire during this time. There was, but they were all localized rebellions, and most of the time there was nothing of that sort going on. So it was a time of prosperity in the Roman Empire, great growth in prosperity, reaching a peak in the early to middle 2nd century AD. This Roman peace was important for the spread of Christianity. One, the peace meant that you didn't have to worry about crossing boundaries that would put you in enemy territory. The Romans built roads all over their empire that were the best roads over any kind of area like that that existed until after the automobile had been invented until well into the 20th century. Because Rome controlled all this, there was a lack of national boundaries in the sense that you would need anything like passports or that sort of thing. Yes, there were local languages in the various areas, but in the eastern part of the empire, Greek was spoken most everywhere by at least lots of people, and in the western part of the empire, Latin was spoken by most people. A little about the Herod family. Herod, of course, Herod the Great, and some of his descendants are rather important in the New Testament history. The father of Herod was named Antipater, and he had been an advisor to Hyrcanus II and kind of the power behind the throne. Antipater was not Jewish, he was an Idumean, an Edomite, okay? But the Idumeans had been forced to become Jews back during the Maccabean period, and so Antipater was at least nominally Jewish, worshipped the God of the Bible and such. When the various changes in power took place among the Romans, Julius Caesar rewarded Antipater for his help in making him procurator of Judea, the one who had responsibility for the emperor's finances, or the Romans' finances in the Middle East, in Judea. Okay? And Antipater then, in true Roman style perhaps, or Middle Eastern style, made his sons Phasael and Herod administrators under himself. Antipater was assassinated in 43 AD, and in 42, Herod the Great, the Herod of Herod and Phasael, was appointed joint tetrarch with his brother Phasael, which means the ruler of a quarter of a kingdom. But in 40, Phasael was killed by the invading Parthians from the east, and Herod fled to Rome. In the same year, Herod was able to get the Roman Senate to appoint him king of the Jews, and give him authority to go back and wage war against the Parthians. They didn't provide money for this, but the opportunity to raise money, to borrow money for this, and in 3 years, Herod had reconquered Jerusalem. Herod's throne was rather insecure from then until the death of Mark Antony and Cleopatra in 31 BC. But after 31 BC, Herod ruled with relative security for the rest of his life. He had terrible family troubles, however. part of it was a combination of various conniving among his relatives and other courtiers, and part of it was due to Herod's own suspicion bordering on paranoia. Eventually, Herod will kill his favorite wife and three of his sons, among many others. But Herod is called the Great not because of his terrible family troubles and how he handled them, but because of his accomplishments in regard to the fact that he ruled a very large territory, that he renovated the Jerusalem temple starting in 19 BC down to his death, and that he had great building projects in Caesarea on the coast and Sebastia, where the city of Samaria had been. We hear about Herod killing the children of Bethlehem in the opening chapters of the Gospel of Matthew, and although we have no independent support for that, it fits very well Herod's own character, as we see in other things. He, for suspicions, kills his favorite wife and kills two of his sons who are the sons of that wife because he fears that they're plotting to get the throne, and then late in his life, he kills a third son. So bad was that the Roman emperor would be Augustus at this point. Basically says it's safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Herod was apparently fairly kosher. His pigs were safe, but his sons were not. Well, what about Herod's sons and descendants? Herod ruled by his... Herod made a will, and his sons ruled by his will after his death. The will had to be... validated by the emperor. Archelaus ruled over Judea, Samaria, and Idumea till 86. Antipas ruled in Galilee and Perea till AD 39. And Philip ruled in Iturea Trachonitis until AD 34. Herod had some other descendants by Mariamne, a grandson, Herod Agrippa I, who became king of the Jews from 41 to 44, and his son, Herod Agrippa II, who became a king, never king of the Jews, until about 100. Just a word about Messianic expectation. We're running out of time on our recording equipment here. There was a great deal of Messianic fervor by the end of the Intertestament period. Interest in the person of the Messiah, various views on the Messianic period, and we suggest a typical order of events. Messianic fervor was very strong in the first century AD. Dissatisfaction with the Roman rule, zealot leaders calling for revolt, and this messianic fervor was very influential in leading many Jews to participate in the revolt against Rome, AD 66 to 70. Probably one of the reasons for this was that Daniel's prophecy of 70 weeks looked like it was running out. I don't believe the people at that time knew exactly when it had started, but they knew it must be about running out at this time. There were a variety of views on what kind of person the Messiah would be, and these changed over time. The early interpreters see the Messiah as more than human, though they have no clear view of the Messiah's deity. Later rabbinic materials tend to minimize the importance of the Messiah. There are a number of Old Testament paradoxes regarding the Messiah, regarding his office and activity and being and coming, and we suggest in another of our PowerPoint talks that this is a place where the New Testament and its model of the Messiah and its candidate, Jesus, solve these Old Testament paradoxes in a striking way. There were various views of the Messianic period among the Jews at this time. Some believe there would be a Messianic period only, what we would call a millennium in Christian circles. Some believe there would be an eschaton only, what we might call an amillennial scheme in our terminology. And others believe that both would occur, the Messianic period first and the eschaton after it. That was the most common view. These alternatives somewhat resemble the postmillennial, amillennial, and premillennial Christian views. According to the end-time events, signs will precede the end. There'll be moral decay, disaster. There'll be signs. There'll be a forerunner. Messianic kingdom will be established. The return from exile of the Jews. Nations punished. Messiah rules. And then the days of the Messiah, what we call a Christian millennium. Variable features seen in these works. Length uncertain, etc. Ends with rebellion. And then the age to come, equivalent to the Christian eternal state. Resurrection, judgment, eternal states. Just a word about the end of the Jewish state. The Roman procurators ruled from 6 to 66 AD over Judea. The first Jewish revolt took place in 66 to 73 AD. And then afterwards, Yohanan ben Zakkai, a rabbi, got Roman permission to continue a school and court at Jamnia, rebuilt Judaism without sacrifice. Christians weren't excluded from the synagogue, and this led eventually to a second revolt, the Bar Kokhba Revolt, 132 to 135 AD, when the Romans attempted to rebuild Jerusalem as a pagan city, and a fellow named Simeon ben Kosiba revolts and was recognized as Messiah by one of the rabbis. The revolt was put down with much slaughter, and the Jews were forbidden to come near Jerusalem. Well, that's a quick tour of our period, and I hope that will be helpful in background.